Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Tonight's forum is the next to last of the season at the All Souls Church. We will be hearing from Jan Markison, and she's going to talk about the City Council just adopting a new $1.5 billion budget for next year. And we're going to hear all about it on tonight's forum. I have to tell you that in the second portion of the forum tonight, we had some sound issues. There was some interference in the recording, so I had to lift out a few minutes of the Q&A session in the second hour because it just was not listenable, unfortunately. But I don't think you'll detect that it's gone, but my apologies to those folks that asked questions during that segment that won't get aired this week. But sometimes these things happen. Fortunately, they're very rare. This program was recorded on Sunday, May the 24th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. That's at 4501 Walnut Street. We will go to our usual format tonight. We will hear an introduction, and then we'll take a short break, and then we'll hear a truncated question and answer segment in the second portion of the program tonight. So, welcome, and let's sit back and listen to see how the city might be spending the $1.5 billion budget for next year.
Good morning. I'm Michael Duffy, member of the All Souls UU Forum Committee. This morning we have as our speaker Jan Markison, who is currently a member of the City Council, about to leave the council due to term limits in the next couple of months, and has for a long time served as chair of the City Council's Finance and Budget Committee. The council just a few months ago adopted a budget of $1.5 billion. Discussing the budget doesn't always sound like very exciting discussion, but in fact it's where priorities meet the resources in city government. It's where we decide what's important for our citizens. Jan Markison has had to sit in the middle of that discussion, and she's here today to talk about how she made it happen. Please welcome Jan Markison.
Well, thank you. It's so good to be back at All Souls. I've been here before, but it's always fun. We live right in the neighborhood, so glad to be here. It was really interesting this morning when I was thinking about it, because I go to church down at Community Christian, and today is Pentecost Sunday, and we celebrate that in our church. And one of the interesting things that kind of reminded me about this type of work I'm undertaking is part of the Pentecost celebration. Everyone from all over, they were all speaking in their native tongues at one time. And everybody could understand everybody else. And I was thinking, that's a little bit how I feel sometimes as a city council member. And it's kind of our job to be able to listen, and to listen to disparate points of view, listen to people who do speak and think differently than I might, but yet understand what they're talking about, and to make good decisions based on input from a lot of disparate points of view. So I really thought it was very appropriate to speak here on Pentecost Sunday about the budgeting process, which, like Michael says, may sound a little dry, but I think it's really been interesting. And I've been on the Finance Committee in both terms of my service. And so I really do have a long history of almost 9 years on budgeting. So I think one of the most important things when we talk about budgeting is that it really starts with a shared vision for where the city needs to go. So during the past two terms, and I feel like I had some input on this, especially during my first term, the mayor and the city council, and we have Tim Higgins here who also helped us with our visioning and our goal setting, we got together and we created a mission or vision statement and a shared vision for where we thought our city should go collectively. And the vision that we adopted for our city is that, quote, our local government will be nationally known for its transformative efforts that make Kansas City the diverse community of choice for people to live, work, and play as a result of its business, educational, and cultural opportunities, sustainable, vibrant neighborhoods, safety, and vitality. And we really parsed each of those phrases and words, and every word and every phrase has a real meaning to the council, and we are trying to live out that goal. And likewise, goals were adopted that corresponds to each of the primary functions of our city government, pretty much as they relate to each of the committees on the council. So an overarching goal of our whole council and government is that we have good customer service. And so one of our very first goal is that we will create an internal culture that operationalizes the focus on the customer across all services provided by the city. And my husband was asking me, what does that really mean? And it just means that embedded in all of our job descriptions, embedded in all of our training, embedded in all our conversation, is that we want to put our customers, which we think are our residents, first. And so I really think that that has had a very beneficial effect on our customer service, and we see that because we do citizen satisfaction surveys every quarter. And fortunately, over the 8 years I've been on council, especially this last four, I will say they've improved more in the last four, we are having better customer satisfaction. And part of that is we've also committed ourselves to be data-driven. So not only do we have lofty goals, but under each of those goals, we have some real outcomes measurements, and we know whether or not we are going the right way to our goals. So I have been chair of the Finance, Governance, and Ethics Committee, so I'll speak a little bit about the goal that was adopted that relates to that committee. So the goal of the Finance and Governance Committee says that we will strengthen, expand, and make judicious use of Kansas City's economic resources in order to achieve short-term and long-term prosperity. So to this end, our city council, and at the request mainly of our finance department, we've really adopted some pretty, I think, sound financial policies, and they regard that with regard to pension reform. That's been something that has been, you know, troubling our city for quite some time. The level, what should our fund balance be? What's our rainy day fund? What level should that be? And the reason that's important, number one, if there were to be a disaster, if there were another flood or another 9/11 downturn in the economy, you need a healthy fund balance. But the other part of that, why that's so important, is when we go to borrow money, the bonding agencies look to see how much we have in our fund balance. And that is a part of their decision in what our bond rating should be, which means how expensive is it going to be for us to borrow money, which we need to do the projects. And so when I started on the council in 2007, we had a fund balance that was 2% of our general fund. That is really insufficient. I think a lot of councils, I mean, you may have been supportive, actually, of this decision. There was a time where our council did not approve any increases in our water and sewer rates, and so we really used up all our capital. And so that was one of those short-term financial decisions, but it was not healthy for the long-term. So our goal is to have an 18% fund balance. So we've gone from 2% in 2007. We want to get to 18%. And I'm very, very proud that during this poor economic time, we've increased our fund balance to almost 10%. So to go from a 2% of the budget fund balance to a 10% balance under very difficult economic times, I feel pretty proud about that. We also have policies on how much debt we should incur, and I know you read a lot about the Power and Light District, the amount of debt that our city, so we have a policy talking about that. And another policy that is maybe inside the ballpark is we want to make sure that we have a structurally balanced budget. And what that means is in the past, by charter, we have to have a balanced budget that we adopt. We can't, like the federal government, we can't run a deficit. So in the past, there was a tendency to underestimate the expenses. For example, we would put in the budget that our snow removal would be $1 million. Well, we knew full well that our snow cost was about $2.5 million. So there was this false sense of what our revenue and expenses were. And we knew it, but we balanced the budget. And so a lot of times then we were scrambling. And again, that gets to that short and long term. So this year, it was a little bit controversial, but we put in the budget exactly what we have been paying every year for our fire department. And the fire department has been one of those departments that has a lot of overtime just because of the business model. I mean, if you are sick and you need 2-3 firemen and 4 firemen on a truck and one person's sick, you have to hire somebody to work overtime. So the overtime was running about $14 million, which is, I know that sounds crazy, but we have a very large budget. So this year we put in the budget exactly what over the last 3 years our fire department has cost us, including overtime. So it looked to some that we just, went crazy and notched up our fire department budget, but that was only because we were trying to really be clear about what it actually costs us. And then one of the most important things that we did was adopt a 5-year financial plan. So I'll talk a little bit more about that. But the other part of what the budget is doing, and it relates to the 5-year financial plan, is that we have really been much more deliberate about citizen engagement. And I feel like that's part of what has helped increase the citizen satisfaction as far as the budget goes. In 2005, 25% of the people surveyed felt that they received a value for their tax dollars and fees. So that was not so great. Last year, 37% of our residents felt like they were getting good value for their taxes and fees. That's not great, but it's certainly we're going the right direction, and we know that we have to do better, but at least we have better satisfaction. So I think that one of the ways that we are increasing our satisfaction is because of the way we've changed up our budgeting process. So the voters approved a 5-year financial plan. So the city, every November 1st, has to adopt by charter a 5-year financial plan. So what we have done now is we've changed the entire budgeting process. It used to be, and I know some of you used to come to budget hearings, and the city manager would present the budget to the mayor and city council, and we would have, the $1.5 billion that we had to budget, and then people would come and kind of react to that. And once the budget is designed, there is very little wiggle room. So people would come and they'd say, well, I need $10,000, for this skating, rink in Northland. And so we'd say, oh, okay, we can do that. I mean, that is so minuscule that doesn't really get us where we want to go. So what we did was we said, okay, by November 1st every year, we're going to do a 5-year financial plan. So let's engage people in the late summer and early fall and help us say, where do we want to be in 5 years? So last year we had, I think, 6 focus groups, and there were about 200 people who came together, and we looked at our budget early in the fall. And so we looked at how much we spend on public safety, how much we spend on finance and governing, how much we spend on neighborhoods. And we had good discussions about why we spend so much, 70% of our budget, on public safety, our police and firefighters, and why neighborhoods maybe is declining because of federal grants mainly. So we really were able to engage people in the limitations of our budget, the visioning about our budget early on. So when we presented the budget, when the city manager presented the budget, he could say, we listened to folks, this is what they had to say, and here is where we want to go the next 5 years. And so we still had the budget hearings and we had people kind of react to that, but it's so much more important to be engaged before the budget is presented rather than afterwards and just react to it. So I really felt like that was pretty radical, a pretty radical change, and I was really pleased that we operationalized that. And the other thing that we did was the mayor and the council have been very, very interested in engaging more young people, kind of that millennial generation. So the mayor has this challenge cabinet of those millennials and entrepreneurs, and we engage that group in social media. So I went to watch, but I didn't participate. They had like a live Twitter session. And so, you know, people would, in real time, we had all the department directors, people who do the social media, they had immediate, you know, responses to their questions. They ask, why do we do this? Why do you do that? And somebody, you know, gave that answer and they tweeted it back out to them. So, you know, we really need those young people engaged in the decision making too. So that was a way that we've tried to do that. So I was very, very pleased that we at least now have the structure. And so I am very hopeful that the next council, I mean, seven of us will be gone. We'll have quite a few. We have 12 council members. Seven will be gone. Six of us are termed out, and then one of our council members resigned. So his seat is open. So we will have seven new people. And so I really am cautiously optimistic that they will adhere to the financial restraints that we have put in place. You know, when you're newly elected, number one, you love to do flashy things and you love to build community centers and you love to put in new programs. That's great, but you know, we have a lot of obligations that we need to make sure that we are really still adhering to that fiscal discipline. So I'm just hoping that we will do that. So so think long and hard about who you vote for, I guess is my message to you. So I really feel like that budgeting is really important, especially as the federal and state governments seem to be unable to address some of the problems that usually state and local government and federal government do. I'll say especially healthcare. We still don't have Medicaid expansion in the state of Missouri, nor will we. And you know, Kansas City has voted for that health safety net tax, and it still is woefully, you know, underfunding Children's Mercy, Truman Medical Center, Samuel Rogers Clinic. But that's a function of the state. Our state should be doing that, and instead, we have had to take that responsibility on as a city. So that is really. We really have to watch those types of things. We have some other goals that our finance committee, one of the major goals is to make sure that the taxes that are in place currently are retained. I'll talk especially about the earnings tax. The earnings tax will be up for a vote in April of 2016. The earnings tax is about 40% of our general fund revenue. So if we were to, the state of Missouri adopted a statute and then put to the voters, actually, and so the voters adopted, that we have to renew our earnings tax every 5 years. So every 5 years we have to make a case that the earnings tax will be renewed. And you know, we've had very good support for the earnings tax. It usually gets like 60, 65% of the vote. The problem is, when we go to the bonding agencies, when they see 40% of our revenue source has to be renewed every 5 years, they're a little nervous that what would happen if it weren't renewed some year. I mean, what would the city do? So we really have to convince our bonding agencies, and so we'll have that opportunity if we keep getting the level of support we've had in the past for the earnings tax. It's easier to make a case, but people hate taxes right now. So we are always cautious about feeling like the earnings tax will automatically be renewed, because that's not true. And the other thing I briefly talked about was when we had our citizen meetings, our focus group meetings, when citizens realized that 70% of our general fund budget is for public safety, our police and our fire departments, they start getting, you know, concerned that why are firefighters and police earning so much? You know, that's our major function of government is police and fire safety, is public safety. Correspondingly, because that is such a high expenditure, that is our those two services get the highest level of customer satisfaction. So people feel that 85% of the people are satisfied with our police and fire protection. And I think in these days, we can all feel very good about that, given the police support in other areas of the country. So we really do value our police and fire safety, but they do eat up a lot of our general fund. So that just means less is available for codes enforcement and for neighborhood revitalization. So we're really, really trying to make sure that we balance those costs. But I mean, I think obviously what you know is that our firefighters and our police are bound by labor agreements. And so a lot of times, even though we voted for a five-year financial plan that includes no salary increases next year for any government employees, our police and our firefighters now are in negotiations, and they're not really crazy about that provision. So they want a salary increase. So even though all 13 council members voted for the five-year plan for no salary increase, I have a feeling that 13 people will not say, yes, let's not do what the firefighters want, and let's go ahead and give them a salary increase. And if we do, that really troubles me. So the other, and I will just briefly touch on this, but because we don't want to, when we talk about our public safety budget, our police and fire budget, we don't want to do anything that takes cops off the street. We've done a really good job of citizen engagement with our police. So we're looking at a lot of other ways to cut costs, and it mainly revolves the civilian personnel that work in the police department. We really want to combine our efforts to have a combined human resources function, a combined fleet maintenance, combined IT purchasing, and that's taking a while. But one thing we did that for some reason got to be controversial was we decided to take our ambulance billing, and instead of having joined the ambulance and the fire departments together, one thing we were made very aware of was the ambulance department billing for Medicaid is a very laborious and confusing and difficult if any of you have Medicaid, Medicaid. It's very technical, and so it's hard to collect. We were only collecting about 2% of the Medicaid reimbursements that we were getting. So we decided, well, one thing we can do that won't take any of the fire personnel off the trucks is to look at the people who are doing billings and hire a firm that's their job. And we were not able to do that for various political reasons, but Midterm, we were able to contract with that company, get improved software, and we're actually, because of those, that sort of short-term fix, we are able to collect about $1 million more each year in Medicaid billing in our ambulance service. But we still have a long way to go, because currently our ambulance service is $4 million in the red. So It's very, there. Some of the decisions we make, they really have very sound rationale, and you don't always get the full picture. So we're really trying very hard. So I really feel like that the citizen engagement and the data-driven decision-making are the hallmarks of our council term, this past term. So I don't know if any of you have ever gone to the mayor's KC Stat sessions or the watched it on Channel 2, but it's really interesting. He's got these really genius young people that they take our goals, and they really every quarter they give a analysis of how we're doing in all of our different for our goals. So there's one in finance next week, so I'm very interested to see where we are. But it's called the KC Stat. So everything we do, we set these goals, but we also set performance measures, and we actually measure it. And then so the next time we can say, well, we're doing a good job, or we need more resources in order to be successful. So I really feel like I've been proud of my service on the City Council. It's been a really interesting 8 years. And we were at a Citizens Association forum, and somebody says, well, what surprised you about City Council, being on City Council? And I hadn't really thought too much about that, because I get surprises every week. But I think the larger surprises, one, and it's maybe it's a lesson learned, was the importance of leadership qualities. And you want your people in who are governing to have appropriate leadership qualities. And I think that you saw, we saw the difference in the first term that was a little bit tumultuous. And Sly James is really, he has those type of leadership qualities. You may not always agree with him, but he's direct, he's a cheerleader, he is has reasoning for what he's doing, and he's able to, you know, get people to work with him. And so I think the leadership qualities, and I think the second thing was I didn't really realize what excellent professionals we have working in the city. I think it's so easy to say, oh, people work for the city because they can't get any other job, or, you know, city people are just not very responsive, or city people don't work very hard. I'll tell you, in my experience, that is definitely not the case. I mean, we have people at City Hall, the attorney who works in the finance group, she's been there 25 years. She is so dedicated, she is so bright. Our finance director is just amazing. Any of the Fortune 500 companies would be well served by having some of our professionals, on every level. And I think, now that they feel like they're appreciated and that they know that we're going to support them, you know, people have really risen to the challenge. So I am very, very pleased about that. And I think one thing that I've tried to really stress is to know my place. I think as a city council member, we are the policy makers, and we have this excellent staff. And so if we try to micromanage them, it only causes problem. We set the policies, and I think we've set some very, very lofty policies. And if our city manager is not, his staff is not getting us where we need to go, that's on him. I'm not going to tell the finance people how they should be doing their job. We can say what their job should be, and they've got to figure out a way to do that. So I think that there's always some questions about what the council manager form of government, whether that's the right way to go, or I know every mayor wants a strong mayor form of government. Every mayor does, because they want to be the boss. And we've always rejected that. We like good mayors, we like strong-ish mayors, but for this city, it seems like the council manager form of government has served us well. And the city manager, I'll tell you, Troy Schulte is an excellent city manager, and I really enjoy working them. So since my term's up the end of July, I just want to tell the couple of things that I'm particularly proud of being involved in. And the first one, I think I talked about this at an All Souls Forum, and this was never anything I thought that I would get excited about, was its sewers. And so I really got excited about helping make sure that our sewer system was in good working condition, and that we were not dumping a bunch of sewage into our streams and our rivers and the Missouri River and Brush Creek and other places. So I really, again, it's citizen engagement that made this process work, and it goes back to Kay Barnes. She appointed a committee, I can't remember what year it was, but it was during her term, she appointed a committee, it's called the Wet Weather Panel. And for 6 years, a group of citizens, a broad range of citizens, met and really designed a sewage system that met the needs of not only of the EPA, because that was by law, we had to do that, but met the needs of the neighborhoods. And so I think one of the most exciting things is we have this, our Marlboro area of the city, south of Waldo, it's been targeted, and it's kind of, there's the green impact zone, and then there's target green. We used a lot of bump outs, porous sidewalks, a lot of neighborhood revitalization strategies to meet the EPA mandates, but also to help that neighborhood improve, because it needed it, frankly. If you've driven around that area, you know, they didn't have curbs, they didn't have sidewalks, they didn't have much attention from the city. So we gave them the attention to help them rebuild some of their infrastructure, and I think it's really paid off. So I really feel like that is a real positive way to meet a federal mandate, but yet do it in a way that makes Kansas City more prosperous. So the downside of that is, and people are starting to complain, when we did our overflow control plan, we also had a funding task force that I chaired. Our rates have been going up. I think you probably all are aware of that. But our sewer and water rates have gone up because there was a time where our city council, for reasons of their own, mainly because everybody was running for mayor, decided to not raise rates at all. And so that really put our water department in a bind because they didn't have the reserve they needed to borrow money to fix what needed to be fixed. So if you don't have money in your reserve account, nobody will loan you money, just like, you know, the banks won't loan you money for a house if you don't have a way to pay their mortgage. So we really worked very hard to do that. And the other thing that was one of those long-term issues, and actually Mayor Funkhauser appointed a committee that was looked at our pension system. So again, for a year, a group of really dedicated people looked at our pension system and came up with some strategies to stabilize our pension system. And I'm sure if you read about Detroit or Chicago, their pension systems are underfunded, and it has really hurt their financial viability of their city. So Kansas City, we didn't adopt everything that the Pension Reform Committee suggested. It was just too, we couldn't afford it, frankly. And you know, when you give somebody in Missouri, if you are promised something as a term of your employment, which is a pension, that's a contract. And so we couldn't go back and change some of the provisions because we had promised people that level of service. But I will tell you that no elected officials or judges or upper management gets a pension from the city any longer. We get a defined contribution allocation. So we have like a 401k, which is not a guaranteed pension, but it's up to you then to manage that. So for the city, that will be a good strategy for the long run. We still don't have that in our labor agreement. So, but every year we're fully funding our pension requirements, which is a very good thing for our financial security. But it, on the other hand, it's a little bit of a challenge because that takes a lot of money. It was $6 million in this year's budget to meet our requirements. And so that's $6 million that we couldn't spend elsewhere. So even though it's, you know, the things we do are very good. We talked about the short-term and the long-term financial stability. So some of those long-term strategies are painful in the short term. So we have to balance that. So I really feel like the best decisions that we make in our city are done, you know, through citizen engagement, through thoughtful deliberation. And we have some outstanding issues, and I'll just kind of go through this laundry list, and I know that you'll probably have questions, but some of the issues that are going to be coming up for the next council members, and you might want to, if you have forums with council candidates, have you already done that?
Last week.
Okay. Well, be thinking about their responses to here's some of the issues that they're going to be facing. One that's in the news this week is the Convention Center Hotel. And so we did approve a memorandum of understanding with a group of investors of certain provisions. And I guess the funding for the Convention Center Hotel, that funding, it's about $2 million a year, that comes from convention and tourism taxes that are paid if you stay in a hotel or and if you eat in a restaurant in the entertainment district. So it's not like a regular tax on those of us who live here. It's the convention and tourism tax part, and so that it's paid by that, and it's the exact same amount that we're currently paying for the debt on the Kemper Arena. So it's not any new budget item. It's just our debt on the parking garage on the Kemper Arena will expire in next April. So that exact same amount of money will be used to pay bonds for the Convention Center Hotel. So the mayor really, really was resolute in saying we don't want anything that'll affect the city's debt that will be coming from the general fund. So that met all those requirements. That's just a memorandum of understanding with the development group. They still have to go out and get financing. So they have 270 days to get their financing in place. Then the real decision will come to the council. So we have made a preliminary decision to give them a memorandum of understanding that we think that the structure is sound, but it's up to them to get the financing. So there's still a lot of work to be done. The other I kind of mentioned was Kemper Arena. We have put out a request for proposals nationwide to see how that Kemper Arena might be repurposed. And because the West Bottoms has become such a hot place for redevelopment, we want to look at those proposals that not only find a good use for that structure, but might help give an infusion of economic interest in that West Bottoms area. So that's kind of exciting. And so I don't know what we'll get. So that's 90 days. So it'll be after our term's gone. The streetcar is going to be up and running in the downtown loop by the Big 12 tournament next March. So we will have a streetcar. And there was a lot of maybe confusion over our interest in expanding the streetcar, and the vote was not successful, obviously. But the vote from people who live from the Crown Center to Waldo, by 60% they voted to extend the streetcar. So the people on the south leg did express an interest in the streetcar going to UMKC. We've had a lot of that interest. So there are people, not city council, there are people who are beginning to talk about waging some kind of an effort to make sure that once, we're not doing anything right away, but once people get to see the streetcar downtown, then maybe take it back for to see what the temperature might be to get it to UMKC. It seemed like going east was, no one seemed to be interested in that, and that's fine. We know who wanted it and who didn't, so I think that is something that will be coming back, not for a while. The airport, we had another citizen engagement process. Bob Birkebile was the head of that, and David Fowler, they were in charge of that and gave some recommendations. I think one thing we forget is how old our terminal is. It's 40 years old. And I think that what we see is pretty bright and shiny because we've done some of that. But what we don't see is some of the internal workings, the luggage, luggage carriers and the wiring and some of the things. So what we have done is, because Southwest Airline is the major carrier going in and out of KCI, they are now kind of driving the decisions, because it will be paid for by the federal government. When you have a fee on your ticket, when you fly somewhere, part of that tax goes into a pool of money that's used to build airports. So what we've been doing in Kansas City, we've been paying a tax that is being used to build airports, but not in Kansas City. So Southwest Airline and the other airlines, their fees will pay for the airport. So it's not money that could be used for schools. It's not money that could be used for streets. It's not money that can be used for sewers. The airport funds can only be used in the airport. And so, but that decision, again, will be a while. Another kind of topic that has come up real recently is a development east of Troost. For so long, I mean, every mayor, the two mayors I've worked with, I'm sure Kay Barnes felt the same way, but every mayor has wanted to do something in council east of Troost. I mean, we desperately need jobs. We need investment east of Troost. But banks don't, and business people don't, they want to make a profit and they don't see that as profitable. So the city has purchased the shopping center at Linwood and Prospect. And it's been languishing for a long time, and we said we wouldn't purchase it a while back, about two or three years ago, because we didn't feel like we should be in the development business, but we couldn't get any other way to get that revitalized. So the city has purchased that, and we already have a commitment from Sunfresh to put a brand new Sunfresh in that, and we want other things east of Troost, and we want to get a Prospect Max line so we can help that area. So that's big, but it's not, you know, there are some game changers and we need to work harder east of Troost and get things on the east side. And one issue that has come up just recently, and I do have a lot of interest in it, is the petition to that has been approved. About 4,000 people signed a petition to put a minimum wage, increase in the minimum wage in Kansas City on the ballot. And we had some legal wrangling. At first, our legal opinion said that by Missouri statute, we are precluded from putting a minimum wage on the ballot if it's higher than what the state minimum wage is set at. So, and then the state of the Missouri legislature adopted a bill that looked like it maybe gave us a window of opportunity to increase our minimum wage. So there's still legal opinions on both sides of that. But instead of just putting what the petitioners had adopted, we have been meeting with them and we are in discussion. We have a window of opportunity to August 28th. So according to the current legislation that still hasn't been signed by the governor or vetoed, we don't know what he's gonna do. We have a window of opportunity to August the 18th to possibly change what the minimum wage is in Kansas City. And so we have said we just don't want to do things quickly. And for my biggest anxiety, I'll tell you, I worked in social services for 20 years. I don't want to set an artificial minimum wage that will harm people who are reliant on child care subsidies, housing subsidies, food subsidies. Sometimes if we don't do it the right way, we might be increasing the minimum wage to a level that would cut out some of their benefits and would actually be doing more harm than good. So, you know, I'm just continue to ask, just do the math and make sure that if we do, and if we are able to increase the minimum wage, we're doing it in a way that actually will help people have a better economic future rather than some of these moms. I've heard, and Sister Berta from Operation Breakthrough testified, we really have to be cautious because if we raise the minimum wage, if we raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour, that mom will lose $100 per month for each child in child care subsidies. That's just one subsidy. So if she cannot make up that, you know, $100 or $200 if she has more than two kids difference, then actually we're putting her in a worse financial position. So I think everybody agrees people need to be making more money. There's, obviously there are people who just can't make it on the salaries that they have, and we need to help them. But we need to be thoughtful about it, and we need to do it in a way that actually does help and not provide them any disincentives. So that's kind of where I see, you know, some of the big issues that are still out there. So when you are making your decisions about who to vote for, when you're talking to candidates, I mean, those are some of the issues that I think are going to be critical to our longer term and some short term financial stability. So I will stop there. And if there are questions, is that?
Good job. Thank you.
You're listening to City Council Member and the Finance Committee Chair, Jan Markison, talking about the new budget for Kansas City. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Just a reminder that you can catch the podcast of this program within a week or so of this broadcast. There are other podcasts of this program on the KKFI website at www.kkfi.org. www.kkfi.org. That's www.kkfi.org. And you can listen to previous programs in this series. Let's take a short break and we'll be right back and we'll delve right into the questions from the audience on this week's All Souls Forum.
Well, thank you. That was a great presentation. I feel I learned a lot from it. Anyway, I have two quick questions. One, if there is a level of underfunding for the pension system, how serious is it? You know, we hear stories about Chicago, you know, and so I wonder if you could quantify that. And also the debt load that the city is carrying, you know, how significant is it, and how do we compare to other municipalities, et cetera? So, and where do we want to be? So.
Good. Those are good questions. We have a higher debt load than most cities our size. And we are aware of that, and the bonding agencies are aware of that, but we still have a AA and AA plus bonding a rating from the agency. So we were able to, especially the Power and Light District, we have a higher debt than most cities because when we did, especially the Power and Light District, we did spend a lot to build those the structures, but we also put all brand new infrastructure underneath it. So we put all new water and sewer lines, and we changed all the electrical lines. So underneath that, the amount that we put that you see above the ground, we put quite a bit of infrastructure financing in there too. So we do have a higher. That's why we were very resolute in saying that if we do get a convention center hotel, we will not guarantee the bonds for that. So we really need to stop doing that. I mean, I think that most people, not all, but most people feel like our downtown was in desperate need of something. And so we tried to get the right investment, and it's still gonna take the city's obligation. And we spend about $14 million a year paying off the bonds for downtown. So we can't really incur a whole lot more debt. Our pension system, it is still somewhat underfunded. Some of the pension, we have four different pension plans. Some are as high as 85% funded, but some are in the 70% rate. So we are in so much better position than Chicago or Detroit or other cities that you read about. And because we have this ordinance in effect that we every year have to pay our actuarially required contribution, the bonding agencies are thrilled about that. So and sometimes you say, well, you don't, there are those who say you don't want to be 100% funded because then people just want more benefits. So you want to kind of keep it. 85 is about the average, good average amount. Yes, hi.
Good morning. I'd like to ask a question about the crossover between the leadership component you mentioned and public engagement, specifically in the context of the airport. The Airport Terminal Advisory Committee made a very, very specific recommendation that during this current phase of the discussions, that there be a continuation of a lot of openness about what was happening up there at the airport. To my knowledge, that recommendation was neither openly dispositioned nor has it been followed through on. So I guess I'd like to hear your views about why it is that a year's worth of effort in creating openness seems to have withered during a critical phase of the project.
I think because now we kind of did throw it over to the airlines because we knew that they would be the ones paying for it. And Southwest in particular, they pride themselves on low rate fares. So they were not willing to agree to anything that would make their fares not competitive. And so what they've been doing now, since they did get that, there was a wide citizen engagement. And I think what they did was they got a lot of the input during that process. And then the time right now is for the financial advisors and the airlines to come back to to the community and talk about the plan. So I think this has been one of those times where we got the citizen engagement, we threw it back to the financial advisors and the airlines. They've been doing calculations and negotiations, and a lot of that is confidential. So they will be coming back. We will not do anything that does not come back to the community for engagement. But you're right, it has gone silent.
Good morning, and thank you for coming. Some of the people involved in ongoing efforts to preserve and increase our transit options are very concerned about the fact that 82% of all the people in the city cannot reach destinations for employment within a reasonable amount of time. So my question for you is, in relationship to funding the bus system, what do you feel is a justification for taking some money from the bus system for the streetcar and also not properly adjusting for the actual amount of taxes that have come in relation to funding for the buses?
That's a really good question. And I served on the Transportation Infrastructure Committee my first term, and I haven't this term, but I serve on the Mid-America Regional Council Board of Directors. And Mid-America Regional Council has identified, and I wish I were more prepared for this, but they've identified how low the percentage of people who need public transportation, who can get to their job within 90 minutes, and I think it's something like 10%. So only 10% of the people who need public transportation can get to their workplace within 90 minutes. And I mean, that's obviously inexcusable. So I think for quite some time, and I think it was obvious with the change in leadership at the ATA, I mean, we don't want the ATA to be considered just the bus service. We want a metropolitan-wide system of transportation so people can get, without cars, without owning a car, some by choice and some by circumstance, without a car from where they want to go to their home or to other places. So I think for a long time, ATA was just the bus service. And so we had a pretty good bus service, although there are some that question that because of the buses that aren't fully, the routes that aren't fully utilized. So there is a Transportation 2020, I think it is, that, and I can't remember the percentage, but that X number of people will be able to get to their jobs, at least tripling the number now, within 90 minutes. If we look at our transportation system holistically, and that includes the streetcar, that includes our bus service, that includes Mike Sanders' rail service from the suburbs, that includes even things like, you know, our share fare and some of the transportation kind of niche things. And, you know, to an extent, it even includes things like the Uber discussion. I mean, there are many, many, many zip cars, bicycles, you know, walking. There are many, many ways people get from place A to B. And we haven't done a very good job of scoping that out. And I think that was Joe Reardon, is the new chair of the president of the ATA. That was one of his major reasons he was chosen, is he is a metropolitan-wide collaborator, and that a lot of the jobs are in Johnson County, and a lot of people who need jobs live in the center city. It's very hard to get between those two places, and Wyandotte County as well. So we really need to look at the transportation system. But when you talk about money being siphoned from the bus system, and you know, I know that's been thrown around a lot, but some of the money that was part of the money, the tax, there is no question about it. There's one part of the tax that has to go to the ATA. There's another part of another tax that can be used for transportation costs. And one of the costs of transportation is maintaining the roads. Because if you have roads that aren't maintained, your buses can't successfully maneuver them. Or traffic lights that are synchronized, so you're not stopping every, you know, block. And because that's bad for the timing, it's bad for the environment, it's bad, you know, just for many reasons. So we really, the part of the tax that is dedicated to the ATA, there is no question that goes right to the ATA. The part of the tax that's available for transportation is used for part of the bus service, but also for other ways to make sure our transportation system works properly. Did that answer your question? But it's a huge issue. And I'm not an expert on transportation, but I know that it's something our city has been grappling with, and that Joe Reardon, I have a lot of confidence in his ability to lead. And the board of the ATA under Robbie Mackinnon, who was one of Mike Sanders' appointees, he's the president of the board. He has done more to make the transportation system a metro-wide, you know, it was almost unheard of for Johnson County to begin being a part of the metro-wide ATA. Now they're supporting the metro. They were their own entity. Independence decided to break off and be its own council, not raising any water and sewer rates for 3 years, I think it was. And I think a lot of that was because they were all positioning themselves to run for mayor. I mean, we can't do that again. So if people, you know, make these promises, and you know, I know it's hard, but it, you know, we really have to look at the long-term financial stability. Because, you know, there's not a lot of wiggle room. And we have to kind of make sure we are targeting our money where it's going to get the best bang for the buck. I think we've kind of been doing that with our Green Impact Zone or Target Green. We're looking at the urban neighborhood initiative that the Chamber's doing with Diane Cleaver's leadership. They look at a specific neighborhood and say, okay, if we make this neighborhood, you know, viable, it'll ripple out. You know, not try to do everything. You know, I think that was kind of, people have criticized the way the public infrastructure taxes are divvied up. At this point, when the capital improvement sales tax, it's just divided by six. You know, and so each district gets a sixth of the pie. And one thing that's a challenge for the fourth district is we have downtown, we have the West Bottoms, we have the Crossroads, we have now the Northeast, we have Briarcliff, and we have probably more than a sixth of the expenses, and we definitely have more than a quarter of the parks in the city. So dividing it by six, I know it sounds fair, but you know, overall it's a challenge. And so, you know, some of those decisions are done so everybody feels like I can say, oh, I got what I needed for my constituents. But we need to be really, and that's pretty unrealistic, we need to think of the city as a whole.
A follow-up to that is, on the five-year plan, what information has been available about that that's been published so that people have a broad view of the direction that the city has adopted?
Okay, we do have a website, and we have a really robust data set on the website. It has every line item in the budget. It has the budget. If you're like me, you probably don't go to the website and do a lot of research. So we don't print budget books anymore. But there is a part of our finance department on the website that would have the five-year financial plan. And if you call my office, we can direct you to that part of the website. But the city website has tons of information, but you know, probably most of us don't sit there and read it all the time.
Okay, Jan, thank you very much for
it.
You've been listening to City Council member Jan Markison talking about the new budget just adopted by the Kansas City Council of $1.5 billion. This program was recorded on Sunday, May the 24th, at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut here in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is edited and produced for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help in producing this program each week. The theme music that you are hearing in the background is composed and played by Kansas City musician Fred Potter. So stay tuned each week, right here at this place and time, for the All Souls Forum. We'll see you again next time.